This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Medicine is a strange and in many ways disturbing business, writes my guest, Dr. Atul Gawande. He says, there is science in what we do, yes, but also habit, intuition, and sometimes plain old guessing. The gap between what we know and what we aim for persists, and this gap complicates everything we do. Dr. Gawande is a resident who is close to completing his training in general surgery at a Boston hospital. He's also the son of two doctors. He writes about medicine and science for The New Yorker magazine. Now he has a new collection of essays called Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science. Several of his essays are about fallibility, how even the best doctors make mistakes. I asked him to describe a mistake he made in the operating room.
This was a patient who'd come in after a car crash, and she was not breathing when she arrived. You immediately try to put a breathing tube down into her throat so that you can pump air into her lungs, and it would not go. There was bleeding coming up from her mouth to the point that her airway then became completely blocked off, and we had to do an emergency tracheostomy. It was a crazy night with already a person who'd come in to the emergency room stabbed in the neck, and our attending trauma surgeon was down in the operating room with that gentleman. And so it was left to me, and at that point I was a third year of training. I had done a couple of tracheostomies before, but certainly not in an emergency setting. But I knew that it came down to my finding my way in.
You should just very briefly describe what the procedure is.
So what you have to do is cut down into the trachea, right into the neck, and find a way to get a breathing tube that could go into the lungs and pump air back through.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know quite where to cut, I made my best calculation and did it. But it was almost too late. By the time I found what I thought was the airway, she had arrested. Her heart had stopped beating. The attending surgeon had then made it upstairs from the operating room by that time and found her, found us doing chest compressions. He took over, but there was maybe a minute left before we thought her brain could be damaged, and he could not get it. And the only thing that averted total disaster was that the anesthesiologist gave one more try from above, as we would say, trying to put a tube back down through the mouth, and used a child-sized tube. And that actually reached down into her lungs. We were able to bring air, provide oxygen to her, and she came back.
On those occasions when you have made a mistake,
yeah,
have you discussed it with patients? Can you do that?
You have to. But it's terribly hard. The hard part is, I'll give you the example of the woman that whose tracheostomy we did not succeed with. We did tell her that we had tried and we had failed, and that as a result of that, there was a long period in time, a full 24 hours where we were not sure she would wake up at all because she'd been without oxygen for so long. And we did have to tell the family, look, her airway had shut down. We had tried to get an emergency tracheostomy to open up her airway, but we had failed. It's one of those situations that makes it very hard to... you're very aware of the legal ramifications of what you're saying. But I think we owe it to ourselves to put those legal ramifications aside and speak with candor to patients about what has happened to them or to families about what's happened to their loved ones.
How does the threat of malpractice suits affect what you're trained to do or to say to patients and their families when something does go wrong?
You know, it's funny. We don't have any formalized training about how to speak to patients and tell them what's going on. In medical school, you do have sessions where you'll even be videotaped going through an interview in an office with a patient who comes in with a belly pain or something like that. But this process is instead this process of coping with complications or how things go wrong is something that you absorb simply as an apprentice, watching other people, seeing how they do it. I think that it's really hard trying to grasp that if your physician is infallible and things go wrong, how can they also be doing things successfully? And you have, on the one hand, the notion that 97, 98% of the time, things do go uncommonly well, and somehow these ordinary people are able to do extraordinary things. But it's the moments of failure, which everybody struggles with and remembers, and I think we either have the choice of trying to paper over those moments or face up to them and try to explain them and then begin to grapple with how we can reduce the likelihood that the errors will happen, and then also acknowledge the patients when the errors do happen.
My guest is Dr. Atul Gawande. He's a resident in surgery at a Boston hospital. He also writes about medicine and science for the New Yorker magazine. He has a new book called Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science. How did you start writing? Did you know that you'd want to practice medicine and write about medicine too?
Well, I came to it long after I'd decided I was going to become a doctor, but it was still early in my training. A friend of mine who'd started Slate Magazine, which is an internet magazine, in its early days, came to me and asked if I would do a favor of him of writing a piece about medicine, because in those days it was early in the beginning of the internet and no one was reading the magazine, and as a result no one was writing for it. And it became a monthly column for me and a way I could really begin to use writing as a way of thinking about the dilemmas that came up in my day-to-day practice as a doctor. I got lucky. It turned out one of the few readers was an editor at The New Yorker, and I learned through the grapevine that he was actually liking what I was writing about. And I had a longer piece I wanted to write, but it was too long for the internet. And so I wrote him a letter, and he let me write for, and he said, go ahead. And it became an opportunity then to write regularly for The New Yorker. And I've had the chance to think through problems like mistakes and the areas of medicine which are still a mystery to us, where we don't know everything about what's going on, about unusual operations, and also about this sort of fundamental difficulty for both doctors and patients, which is grappling with uncertainty in medicine.
In your new book, Complications, you have a chapter about pain, and you write, every pain has a story. How true.
Yes.
And you write particularly about a certain type of mysterious pain that doesn't seem to be tied to anything that a doctor can see, either that the doctor can see on the body or that the doctor can see through imaging of the body, through MRIs or X-rays. Give us an example of that type of mysterious pain that the doctor can't explain.
Well, the most common kind is simple back pain. Chronic back pain afflicts millions of people in the United States alone. And yet when you do X-rays and MRIs to find what might be wrong with their spine or their spinal, or the discs around their spine, you often don't find anything structurally wrong. We, in medicine, have a hard time dealing with these patients because what we'll often do is dismiss this as a pain that's all just in the head. And for patients, it's extremely hard to deal with because what they feel is exactly there in their back, and yet they have a doctor telling them, oh, I don't see anything. There's more and more evidence in science and studies that you can have pains, however, that emanate from the brain are completely real. It's as if there's a program for chronic pain that's unreeling in the brain, and that it can start with an injury to the back. And the hard part, I think, for both doctors and patients is grappling with what is not a clearly physical, but not clearly not physical, kind of pain. We end up doing operations on people's backs that are sometimes unwarranted. We end up having patients who feel dismissed because they might be asked to go see a psychiatrist to help sort through the sources of a pain. And in that chapter, what I'm trying to do is explain to people how it is that in this area where we know we're actually remarkably little, we can both make both patients and doctors make judgments that lead us in wrong directions.
My guest is Dr. Atul Gawande. His new book is called Complications. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Atul Gawande. His new book is called Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science. Well, it sounds from your article that one of the theories now is that the pain system itself can go haywire, and it's not necessarily attached to an injury or to a structural problem. It could just be the pain system itself getting out of whack.
That's right. The pain is a kind of program in the brain, and it's almost, you can imagine it as a kind of symphony. There is the feeling of the pain, and there's the memory of the pain itself, and there's all the emotions that go along with it. And what can set the symphony playing is certainly, you know, a hammer to the back. But if you've had a significant injury to your back or anywhere else in your body, it can become possible that the pain program starts to get unleashed with even a normal sensation, just a touch to the back, or sometimes even a depression or social circumstances. That I tell the story of this architect who has had a terrible back pain for 8, 9, 10 years that has made it impossible for him to do his work. He is a guy who built medical schools and now is barely able to make it out of his house. And he's gone for x-rays and MRIs of every kind. And the doctors keep telling him, well, they don't find anything. What seems to be going on for somebody like him, where just sitting in a chair and trying to get up can bring on a pain as if someone has put a knife into his back, is that he is a victim of a problem where his pain system has started to go haywire, go out of control. And we're only beginning to provide answers for medications that actually could focus not on the back, but instead on this haywire pain system, and also find other kinds of treatments that might work as well that may not even be medical or using drugs.
Can you give us an example of one of the new medical ways of treating this kind of pain when what you're dealing with is the pain system itself as opposed to a more physical problem that's manifesting itself in pain?
Well, one of the medications that has turned out to people's surprise to have made a difference is anti-seizure medications. Anti-seizure medications are medications that kind of reduce the threshold at which the brain cells would fire in certain parts of the brain. And an anti-seizure medication can turn out to help for people with these kind of chronic pains that just won't go away and can become so devastating. And it's because we started to shift the focus from trying to figure out what we might do to the muscles in the back there or to the bone or the discs in the back, and to focus then on the pain system itself that's working in the brain.
How does the anti-seizure medication affect the pain system?
Well, what it seems to do, and this is now into a kind of speculation that researchers have as a hypothesis for how it's working, but that it is controlling the, it is stabilizing what may be cells that fire almost too readily. It raises the threshold for when fibers in the pain system would be unleashed and fire. And by raising that threshold, make it easier for the pain system, make it less likely that the pain system would go off with that just the light touch to the back or the day when you find that things just aren't going right and that only compounds the pain that's going on in your back.
You mentioned that toxins are sometimes used to help stop the pain. What kind of toxins, and what's the principle behind using them?
Well, there are these unusual studies using frogs from South America that have poisonous toxins that can kill people. And what researchers have tried to do is tame those toxins by altering them ever so slightly until they reach the point that they're not toxic any longer, but still working on the same brain cells that they targeted in the first place. So instead of killing those cells, they modulate them so that the pain then doesn't occur. One of those drugs has been found to be in early animal trials to be 30, 40, 50 times more powerful than morphine, with the hope that it would be a kind of morphine without those same side effects that morphine can have. These are the early directions that research is going in that's opened up by beginning to think about chronic pain as a problem that is not necessarily just simply the tissues of your shoulder or your back, but instead a process that is centrally in the brain.
So there's a lot of pretty interesting work going on in this area. When you have pain, the doctor always asks you to rate it on a scale of 1 to 10. And yeah. It always seems to me, well, that's such a subjective scale. And is it according to how much you think you could possibly endure? Or are you supposed to be comparing your pain to the average pain? Like, if the average person has pain, how severe is your pain? And how can you know what someone else's pain is like and how your pain might compare to their pain? Is there any way that's a little less subjective of reporting how much pain you're in to a doctor?
There's not, in the sense that, you know, pain is only what you experience. And that's what makes it so hard for you as a patient to convey to doctors. And that's what makes it hard for doctors sometimes to be as aware and sympathetic as we sometimes ought to be. I think what's really important about that question that we ask, you know, rate your pain on a scale of 1 to 10, is number one, that we ask it. It's become the kind of fifth vital sign besides your temperature and your pulse and your blood pressure and your breathing. It's become an important habit for us to ask how much pain you have. And then by asking people to rate it, it tells us how important it is for them, because the sensitivities and thresholds that different people have for pain vary enormously and change over time. There's an interesting and fascinating study of athletes. And I talk, for example, in the book about a study of ballerinas in which it was found that these ballerinas had extraordinarily high thresholds for pain. They tolerated as a daily matter pain that is beyond levels of some of even football players. And it's partly because of their training. It's partly because of the culture of ballerinas to accept the pain. But it also explains why they end up with frequent chronic injuries, because they've inured themselves to pain to the point that their own joints can break down before they recognize what's going on.
Does it frighten you ever to watch your patients go through severe pain and to know the kinds of things that humans sometimes have to endure?
It does. There's a doubleness to doctoring, which is that you are someone who is spending years and years training yourself to be dispassionate and analytical about what you do. You have to be systematic. You have to know the literature. You have to know the science. You have to have experience of dealing in situations so that you make good decisions. At the same time, we are all humans ourselves, subject to the same frailties that our patients have. And being able to grasp those that distinction, not let go too much of one side or the other, is the hard thing to do. I think at times I'm probably too cold, and then at other times you can find yourself absorbed so directly in the experience of what is happening that you have to step back for a minute and remember that this patient needs you to do something and not just feel something.
Well, Dr. Atul Gawande, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
I want to thank you.
Dr. Atul Gawande is the author of Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science. He also writes about medicine and science for The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.